This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I'd like to begin this podcast by thanking E.S. Williams, that's Eli S. Williams, and David Thornburg for their financial support, who are the newest members of the Friends of the Magic Word. It's because of support from friends like them that help keep this podcast going and free for all of you. I would also like to thank all the rest of the Friends of the Magic Word who have made generous donations over the years in order to help keep this podcast online and free for everyone to listen. And I hope that you're enjoying this podcast. And if you do, then you might consider joining the Friends of the Magic Word also. It would be great if you would go to patreon.com and you can then find the Magic Word podcast and give a little donation each month. Just think about buying me a cup of coffee each month or something. It doesn't have to be much. It can be if you wish, but any support would be helpful, certainly, in order to help defray our costs. Speaking of which, I will be traveling soon to Los Angeles to be at the Magic Castle, and in getting out there, I'm going to be working that week and also reporting from what's happening there in the castle and talking with a lot of the people who are working, and over the next ensuing weeks, we'll be broadcasting those conversations that we have for my week at the Magic Castle for 2017. And so I again appreciate the financial donations so this way that we can help defray some of the costs to help pay for rental cars and meals and drinks and whatever that I'll enjoy it whenever I get a chance to chat with some of these great magicians. And you will continue to enjoy that as well. So anyhow, just if you can, that'd be great. You can go to the MagicWordPodcast.com website. There you will see a way to join the Friends of the Magic Word by just clicking on that tab. And you can pay with a one-time donation through PayPal, or you can join Patreon and pledge as much as you want or as little as you wish for a monthly donation. Also, I want to make sure that you hang around until the end of this episode so that way that you can hear who the winners are from last week's contest. That's right. If you didn't listen to it in a timely manner, then you didn't get a chance to enter the contest. But I want to thank the authors, Joshua Stenkamp, and also to Jason Wethington for donating three copies of their book, A Magician Prepares, Act One, Interviews, which I really do recommend. And if you are thinking about buying a copy, I would suggest, of course, you buy it from Amazon, but you need to access Amazon through our affiliate page. In other words, if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, click on the Amazon affiliate link, and it will take you then to your account where you can browse and purchase whatever, and your purchases on Amazon will help support the Magic Word. Well, we are having another interesting conversation here today with a gentleman who is across the pond over in England, and if it wasn't for Roy Marsh, this probably wouldn't have come about. This was another one of those suggestions that had come from a listener who had said that you need to get hold of Terry Herbert. He is an excellent magician and has a lot of great stories, knows a lot of people who have been instrumental in making magic in the UK, and so I thought, well, that's a good idea, and Terry has been around for quite a long time, and everything they said was exactly right, of course. I never really had the opportunity to chat with him. Some of you who are listening to this know him. Others here in the U.S. Perhaps not so well, although he has attended some of the magic conventions. In fact, I think he said he was last year at the Louisville Convention in Louisville, Kentucky, for the combined IBM and SAM convention, where he's performed. And he's performed at a lot of other conventions, Blackpool and elsewhere, and is past president of the IBM British Ring, and helped host the big convention over there. They have, oh gosh, well over 1,000 people who had attended the conventions back then. Anyhow, Terry has been around for quite some time and is a and perhaps was most well known internationally as the Great Fiasco. And in fact, the Magic Hand Studio, back when they were making these monthly posters, beautiful posters, color posters, like of Di Vernon and Ali Bong
Congo and gosh, you name it, just a lot of international acts that the Great Fiasco, that Terry was one of the people who was featured actually on one of those posters. So if you're a collector, you might be able to get your hands on one of those as well. Anyhow, he had a silent 10-minute act. He talks a little bit about that in this upcoming podcast. Well, anyhow, the problem was for a while that I was not able to speak with him because he was having some difficulty with getting his computer to work with Skype in order for this to take place. Well, I contacted the Magic Circle and through their Facebook, our Facebook page, since I'm a member also, and asked for someone to assist. And Roy Marsh, who is one of the compeers and also a stage manager there at the Circle for Monday nights, kindly complied. He just lives about a half hour away. I'd be glad to put this together. So he brought over his laptop and boom, Bob's your uncle. There you go. I mean, just took that quickly and we got it all put together. Thanks very much to Roy Marsh, without whose help, of course, this would not have been possible. Well, I am going to now introduce someone that many of you know and some may not, but after this, he will be a friend of yours as well. He just is the nicest fella, and this is just a most enjoyable and pleasant conversation, even though it was early in the morning for me here in Houston, that it was their early afternoon over there. But so I'm going to introduce our guest for today. Please welcome Terry Herbert here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and it gives me great pleasure to speak with someone all the way across the pond, someone that we've been trying to get together to speak with for quite some time, but technically it's all come together. So here he is, Mr. Terry Herbert. Hey there, Terry.
Hello, Scott. Nice talking to you.
It's my pleasure indeed, sir. I'm glad that you're available. I was going to say up and early, but actually I guess I'm up and early, and it's almost, well, it's the afternoon there for you. So things are
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yep. You've already had a cup of tea. I've just got to get up and get mine here, get going here this morning.
Yeah, we're just having a cup of tea there.
Well, very good. Listen, again, I've been wanting to speak with you for some time because you're a national treasure over there in the UK, and I have not had an opportunity to really get a chance to chat with you, but there have been so many things that you have accomplished and people that you've known and stories I'm sure that you could share. I'd love just to talk with you about a few of those during our time here together. I know that you have been a member of the Magic Circle for a long time and have won the Masculine Award.
That's true.
And that was not that long ago. Was that like 2010?
2010, that's right.
Yeah. I guess all of those who have been your predecessors were good friends. I was looking at the long list of others who have received that, including David Nixon and others. And that was one of the first people I wanted to ask you about. Did you ever work with or know David Nixon very well?
I didn't know him very well at all, but I did meet him. I met him at a convention that was put on by Supreme Magic, Edwin Hooper. And it was at Biddeford. And David Nixon was the guest artist, and I had the pleasure of introducing him on the stage. I was compere of the gala show that time, and a charming gentleman he was.
And he had a television show then in the UK for a number of years, isn't that right?
That's right. Yes, he did.
Now, his style, I assume, was completely different from that of Paul Daniels.
Completely the opposite. In fact, it was when David Nixon unfortunately passed away. Paul Daniels was a completely different character altogether and a complete contrast to David. He was far more, he'd worked the clubs up north and far more aggressive than David was. David was very quiet and very gentlemanly. Mm-hmm. But Paul was at the time. And because Paul did about, I think, 14 series altogether.
Wow, that's quite a few. Now, how many years did David Nixon work?
No, I'm sorry, I can't tell you that. Nixon, how many years was he on the top?
I couldn't tell you without some research, but he was on the BBC and ITV. So
that's right. Yes.
By the way, just want to mention for the listeners that coming in there too, that I want to thank Roy Marsh. Hello there, Roy.
Yes, me too. Yes.
Because Roy was the one who actually helped set this up then today. So thank
without
you
Roy, we wouldn't be talking now, believe me.
Yes, I'm sure. And so
you
thank
might live
you
to regret it.
And now Tommy Cooper was another who had a show there for a long time. Did you know Tommy at all or well?
Tommy Cooper?
Yes.
Yes, Tommy I met many times. A great character. We used to gather at Ken Brook's Magic Studio, and I think Ken Brook would be a name that a lot of your listeners would know.
Yes.
And it was in Ken Brook's Magic Place. And Tommy Cooper, he loved putting stunts on people. I mean, I was a young man at the time. I suppose I was about 19 or 20, and I said goodbye to everybody. That's all right, sir, goodbye. And and I'm halfway down the stairs, and the voice says, "Oh, by the way, Terry. And I come rushing back. He said, "Yes?" And they'd all got their backs to me. And Tommy turned around and said, "What do you want?" I said, you called me. Said, no, I didn't call you. And his voice was very distinctive.
Yeah.
And he only pulled the gag again as I went down the stairs, because Ken Brook's Magic Place was on the third floor, and the voice said, "Oh, by the way, Terry." Like I'm rushing back. He's like, "Yes." And they've all got their backs to me. "What do you want now? Haven't you gone yet?" But that was Tommy. I mean, there are other stories I could tell you, which I don't think I could repeat at this stage. But he was a great character.
Now, you say that was at Ken Brook's Place. So that must have been just a wonderful place to hang out. You know, some of my early memories with my learning magic was really at a magic shop in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, and all the guys that kind of came in. So I imagine that there must have been a lot of great memories and a lot of people who came in and out of Ken Brook's Place.
Well, I would say Ken Brook was my mentor, actually. I loved the guy. He was probably the best magical demonstrator that has ever been. And he was a Yorkshireman, came from Yorkshire, and we used to have big chats together. He used to get all the big names in his studio up there, Ken Brook's. It was in Wardour Street, where all the film studios were. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit tongue-tied here, but it's one of the things that Ken Brook, one of his tricks is a wonderful audio thing that Pat Page did with Ken Brook called It's Better Than Digging Roads. And if you could ever get hold of that, it would give you a wonderful insight of Ken Brook. But I used to do an impersonation of Ken Brook doing the nudist deck. I got 52 pieces of blank pairs there, back pairs, both black and ball pairs and back. And we used to... he was a character. He really was, you know, and a very good magician. He was very underrated, I think. He should have been a big star.
He wasn't the one who published Abra each week, was he? Or was that Ian?
Published Hare? Abra?
Yes.
Goodliffe published
Goodliffe,
Abra.
Goodliffe, that was it. Yeah. Yes. Right. And that was, I want to talk about that in just a minute, but... But back on Ken, as you said, he got a lot of people started in that, and that was Supreme Magic, right, that he owned?
No. Ken started with Harry Stanley's Magic Unique Studio. But before then, before Harry brought him to London, he had his own studio in Bradford, I think it was, up in Yorkshire. I'm just trying to think of the name of it now. Oh, got out of my head. But... He came back. He didn't do too well. The business folded, and Harry brought him down to London to work at Harry's Unique Magic Studios. And he was with Harry for 2 or 3 years, I think. And then after that, a guy called Frank Farrow came on the scene, and he offered to start Ken in his own magic studio. He could back it with, I think it was £2,000. They started in Ken Brook's Magic Place. Mm-hmm. That was his own studio. He wrote the best instructions. This is before DVDs were used to tell you how a trip was done.
Right.
It was all done on paper. And he wrote the best instruction sheets of any dealer, in my opinion.
Did it include all the patter? You know, that used to be a course that they would always include the patter as well as just the trick itself. So was it his presentation as well?
Oh, it was a complete routine, yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, if you had the for instance, the nudist deck, I think it's called something else now, but if you had those, he'd got all the lines that went with every move, and it was done in phases. So you really learned the trick.
Right, right. And as I said, a lot of people kind of came in through. But as I said, it was kind of fun. I remember just hanging out at the magic shop. It wasn't just going in and learning something, or rather buying a trick at the magic shop. It was whoever else was usually there, because they would show you or share some ideas. It was like a magic meeting, basically, you know, where that you had a lot of other magicians who were always hanging out there. That was the advantage of a brick-and-mortar magic shop, that there are fewer and fewer of them, you know. I don't know about over there, but over here in the U.S., they seem to be disappearing.
Well, it's exactly the same over here. I mean, in the time when I'm talking, when I was a teenager, I used to go to, on a Saturday morning, you'd go around all the magic shops, exactly as you were saying, and in those days, there was about 12 dealers in London alone. Now I think there's only, I think there's just, there's International Magic, Lucy, Davenport. Davenport is still going. That's the oldest magic shop in the town. But I think they're the only two magic dealers there are, because everything's done online now, isn't it?
Sure, that's very true, yeah. Now, Davenport, as I recall, used to be like down in the Tubes. Is it still there?
Yes, it's in Charing Cross, in the Charing Cross station. It's in the concourse at Charing Cross station at the Underground. They used to be in Great Russell Street opposite the London Museum, the British Museum, I should say. Mm-hmm. And but they've been now in Charing Cross for some years now. It's run by the son of Fergus and Bessie, Davenport. Roy's up. He's got his own museum. What's the other one's called? It's the son, anyway, that runs the Davenport shop now.
It's not Bill, is it?
Hi?
Bill?
Bill, that's it, sorry. It's Bill Davenport. He's the younger brother, and he runs the shop now.
It seems like some years ago, I recall, didn't they host a magic convention? I don't know that they do anymore.
Oh, yes, they did down in Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
In Brighton on the south coast, they did, what were the other It was a centenary, I think it was, of Davenport at the time.
Yes.
I was there, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I've got one of the little pewter heads that they were giving out as those little gifts, I guess, to register.
Oh, yes, the demon.
Yes, the little demon, yes, exactly.
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at it now. It's up in my glass case.
That's where I put mine. I did not attend, but a good friend of mine, Art Emerson, had come over to visit, and then he brought one back. I don't know if you know Art Emerson or not, from the U.S.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. I met him several times.
Yep.
He used to come over for the British Ring Conventions.
Yes, exactly. Yes, right. I mentioned Goodliffe and and Abra. Were you ever involved with the publication or any of the articles or contributed anything?
No, not really. I knew Goodliffe quite well, and my name appeared in the magazine many, many times where he'd seen me at various conventions. But I actually didn't contribute anything in the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I did for the Magic Gram, which was Hoops Edwin's magazine,
mm-hmm.
for the Supreme Magic, but not in Abra as such, although I got a lot of material out of it myself.
Did you have something that you still do as part of your routine that was something from one of the magazines?
From Abra?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's one particular trick which is based on the Out to Lunch, which was I used for a visiting card. It's the old optical illusion where you've got a cage and a bird, and you hold it close to their eyes, and it appears that the bird goes into the cage.
Oh, yeah.
And when you give them, they sign the cage, and when you give them the card, it's got your blurb on one side, but the bird actually is in the cage when they turn it over. And it's a great – I've used it for many, many years. It's a great gag.
I can imagine that. I can visualize exactly what you're saying there. That is a good idea.
Oh, good, yeah.
Huh. Interesting. We were talking about Paul Daniels for a moment and about how his style completely different from what David Nixon's was. And I remember in talking with Paul before about how he had worked a lot of the clubs – up north, I guess, and he said that it was very difficult. Did you work many of those kinds of those clubs? I'm trying to think of what they were called.
The Working Men's Club.
Working Men's Club, thank you. That's what I was trying to say, yes.
Yeah, well, so, yeah, I never worked them. Because I lived down south. I did a lot of clubs, but that was down south. But the ones you looked like Batley's was a very famous working men's club up north. Mm-hmm. And it was a good training ground. If they didn't like you, they had no hesitation in telling you. So it was a good teething ground up there. If you work the clubs, you could work anywhere.
Right.
But
right.
This, of course, this was where Paul cut his teeth. Right. Was in the clubs up north.
Mm-hmm. And my good mate, and probably yours as well, Terry Seabrook, I think he told me he had worked a few of those from time to time.
I think he did, yes, yes. Another dear friend of mine, Terry Seabrook.
Yeah, I miss that guy. I spent so much time with him, and one of my best friends. I thought it was always interesting in his background, I don't know how many people who are listening to this podcast know that he had actually was an insurance salesman. I believe he was in the insurance business before he decided to turn to comedy, kind of like, I guess, John Archer.
I didn't know that myself.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe he was in insurance business.
Oh, right. Oh, insurance. I thought you said church.
No, insurance. We're talking about Terry Seabrook, yeah. Church? I don't think so.
No, exactly. That's what I was saying, yeah.
No, insurance. yeah, I was going to say John Archer, I know, was a policeman, I believe, before he had gotten...
Who was that?
John Archer.
John Archer. Oh, yes, yes, he was a copper. Yeah, yes. Yeah. We've all had weird professions in the past. I was a toy salesman.
A toy salesman?
Toy salesman, yeah. I actually worked for one of your companies, Mattel,
when they came
over to England.
Yes.
And they opened up in 1969, I think it was. And, yes, I was employed as a salesman for Mattel. It was called Rosebud Mattel. They'd taken over a doll company. And I used to go around the shops selling Mattel toys. Hot Wheels and Barbie. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're all familiar with those.
Right. Did you ever go to the toy shows? I understand that those conventions often employ magicians.
I did, actually. There was actually, after I left Mattel, I turned pro in 1977, and Paul Daniels contacted me. He had his boxes of tricks, and individual tricks were sold. I forget the name of the company now. But he asked me if I would demonstrate on the stand because he was not available. I think actually he was working in America at that time. So I had the job of demonstrating his tricks on one of the toy shows, you know.
Wow. And did you like working trade shows? I mean, I know that you do a little bit of everything.
I didn't do many. The only other toy trade show I did was a computer company. I did a stint on there for a week.
Right.
But it wasn't really my scene, but, you know, it was a good experience.
Well, most of the corporate shows and things you do for adults and executives, what kinds of shows are you working or you do over there?
These days, none at all.
Oh, okay.
I'm very old, but I have done, I used to do a lot of stand-up cabaret for various clubs. I've actually carried most forms of magic, really. I mean, you probably know me as a children's entertainer.
Yes.
Most of my fame, if you like, is a children's entertainer, but I've done as many close-up shows and stand-up cabaret as I did children over the years.
Well, when I was talking with Roy earlier about setting up this chat here, that he said that, or I was saying I know you as a children's entertainer, and he said, "Oh no, he's much, much, much more than that." Certainly,
bless you. Thank you, Roy.
But just with a quick search, even on Google, that many of the things that turn up with Googling Terry Herbert's name has to do with your DVD, which has been highly successful. The Herbert Way, is that the name of the?
That's it, Children's Magic, the Herbert Way. I think that's what kind of got my name about. It was originally put out by Supreme as a VHS video, and then it was bought up by L&L Publishing after Supreme went down, and they sold the rights to L&L. I think they sold the rights to several companies, actually. But L&L Publishing were the ones who put it out. David Kaye came over here, and we had a chat, after one of the conventions, I think it was Blackpool, and he said, you know, have you got the rights? I'd love to have the rights of Children's Magic the Herbert way. And I said, well, I haven't got the rights. It's owned by Supreme, and I think they've sold it to L&L Publishing. Oh, gee, he said. Oh, yeah, I know Louis. He said, I'll have a word with him.
Right.
And they were sitting on it. They hadn't actually published it at that time. And DVDs were coming into operation then. And then they had a look at it and then put it on the market. And it was a bestseller all over again. So it kind of got me known, which was very gratifying.
Well, right. Exactly so. Now, I was going to ask you about the filming of that, because I have gone out with Louis Flanga to record the Psy series with Banachek several years ago, which was one of L&L's popular, still remains one of their popular titles. But the filming of that was so much fun, and it was quite an experience as well. So I just wondered what it was like. I mean, back when you had filmed, when was the original? When did you film this originally?
The original one? Oh, dear. How long ago was that?
I mean, was that back maybe the 1980s, 90s?
I would say so, yes, in the 1980s.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about 27 years old, I should think. You can tell if you look at it. I look like a young boy there.
Yeah, same with the one I was on with Banachek. Yes, much younger. But in recording that, was it basically where they put a camera on you doing a children's show? Did you have a bunch of kids come in, or how was that filmed?
Yes, it was done in Barnstable. Ian Adair produced it. It was Edwin's number one guy. Mm-hmm. And he produced the video. We'd had it done by a professional video company, and we brought in a school of children. And it was all done in one take, actually, if I remember rightly. I did my children's show, and then after the kids had gone, and I explained the different aspects of the show. And I think it was one of the very first children's magic videos that mm-hmm. was made hmm. at the time. And then, of course, when it was made into a DVD, it was, it went all over again a bit. And I still get people kind of contacting me and saying, oh, you know, it was my inspiration, you know. But I did two DVDs, actually. The other one was by Practical Magic. And that they said they wanted to do these. So I did a second one called Magic for Under Fives. And again, it was done with an audience of children from a local school. I always think that is the best way of selling, because they actually see what you're doing working.
Right, right, exactly. And now, when you're saying doing a school, so obviously for a large group as opposed to a birthday party kind of a thing.
Yes, although, I mean, to be honest with you, it's almost basically the same show as I would for a private party, you know.
Oh, that was what I was going to ask you, if that's the case. Is that what you normally would do?
Birthday parties? Yes, birthday parties in schools. The children's entertainment over here is a bit different to you have in the States. I know for a fact that the libraries are a big source of it for magicians out there, but yes. Children's entertainers.
Right.
Whereas not over here. I have done libraries, but it's not the big one.
Hmm.
Most of the shows over here is either schools or private birthday parties. Christenings are coming up now where, you know, where the people having the christening and they have a bunch of kids there and they want them entertained while the adults enjoy themselves with a glass of sherry.
Right.
And it's a little bit different to the States. But one of the things that we do a lot over here is to run the full party. In other words, you do a few games for the kids, but then they have tea and then after tea they have the show.
And are you responsible for running the games as well?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, you do the whole thing. You're booked for like a two-hour party.
Wow.
And in my case, you know, I would do half an hour games before the tea, and then after the tea, which lasted roughly half an hour, then after that we do an hour show for the kiddies. Yeah.
Do you provide party gifts and everything, I guess, as far as like for the games?
No, we don't do that. Well, some may do, but right. I don't personally.
Right. Wow, that's a
lucky get a prize for the birthday kid from me.
Yeah, that's quite different from what they do over here. You know, with birthday parties, at least from my experience and doing them before, I don't focus on children's entertainment like I did in my younger years. But maybe it's just I'm getting older. I don't know. But it's harder to keep up with kids. It's hard enough to keep up with my grandchildren now. It seems, you know. But over here, we basically. we would just go in and do the show and out. You know, they will have already had the games or things in the backyard or playing or whatever. And so we're just there for the magic show. So do they pay more, or is there more or less a standard fee, or what is the range for payment for birthday party magicians?
Now you're asking me now. I mean, it ranges depending on which area you live in. You know, some are better areas than others. I don't think I don't know what the average price is over here. I suppose about £150 is the average price for somebody doing an hour show. And then, but if you're doing the full party, it would go up to about £250. And that's in English sterling.
Okay. Yeah. I was curious to see what that kind of would run over there as well. Now, when you talk about school shows over here, it really gets to be more and more difficult as the years have progressed, in which, from what I understand, I really haven't done school shows, but from what they tell me is that they have to be more themed with some sort of a lesson that they're being taught, you know, against anti-bullying or, you know, reading or no drugs or whatever.
Yeah, I think that is the case in the States, but not so much over here. Over here, it's more like Christmas time, for instance, in December leading up to Christmas. Mm-hmm. The schools have a party for the children, and I do it purely for entertainment purposes only. I don't I know what you're saying, because obviously I've spoken to various American children's entertainers, sure. And that is the thing over there, where you have to do it a theme against bullying or reading or something like this. But no. It's purely entertainment purposes only.
And when you're doing shows over there, do you have, when you were, I guess, with school shows and birthday parties, some guys over here would have like a case that they would just kind of pick up and go, and they would have everything all ready to go, you know, for that show. With the same show for, you know, school after school or child after children, you know, that in my case and probably yours too, whenever that you're working with a corporate client, that I try to customize it for that company and for the number of people and everything, as opposed to a birthday party. It doesn't matter if you've got 12 kids or 24 kids or maybe 240 kids, that do you do the same show for them, or do you have like an A, B, and C show that you might do so you can come back the next year and do a different show?
Excuse me. I know what you're saying. I personally, I have one set show. Obviously, over a length of time, I might take one routine out and swap it for another. But basically, I have the one show. I'll tell you a little anecdote that happened to me some years ago, because I get a lot of children's entertainers saying, oh, well, I change my show every time I do it, you know, for repeat shows. Sure. Well, I tell them, I don't get any repeat bookings, there you are. but on one particular occasion, a mother rang me up and she said, can you do my little girl's party, and can you change your act, because she's seen you 12 times before. And I said, well, yes, it's not a problem. And at that time, I did have a number two show, which wasn't as strong as what I thought was the number one, but okay, I obliged the young lady, the mum. And I turned up at the party, and the little girl's waiting for me on the garden gate, swinging over the garden gate. She rushes up to me. Oh, hello, Uncle Terry. Oh, lovely to see you again. Are you going to do the trick where the gloves get smaller and smaller? I said, not tonight. No, today, darling, because I'm doing something, got some more surprises for you. I wanted to see the glove trick. So it taught me that they want to see the same thing over and over again. You know, they're not bothered about you changing. I change it more for my self rather than for children. Sure. But yeah, you know, that's that's only my philosophy.
No, I think it's an excellent one. I remember David Kay talking about that once. I believe he says that in his book also, but I heard that in a lecture of his once about how that when a child says, oh, I've seen that one before, then some magicians might think, oh, well, I'm not going to do that because you've already seen it. Well, what they're saying is that I've seen it, and in their mind what they're saying is, and I want to see it again. It's kind of like, you know, that, oh, golly, I remember a video that – Pete's Dragon that my son used to watch over and over and over, it seems like, until the tape just wouldn't work anymore, you know. It's just that familiarity of something that it's like playing peekaboo with a child when they're an infant, you know, that they want to see it over and over, you know. It's a surprise, exactly. And they like it, and they have that familiarity. And then as we get grow older and we go to these concerts and we hear one of our favorite rock bands or somebody, you know, playing or singing a song, you want to hear that same old song because it's familiar, reminds you of certain things. So I think that that there's a lot to that, that people, even though they have seen it, and like the fact that young girl has seen you 12 times, she was wanting to see you again to see the same show, to have that familiarity.
Exactly that.
Hmm. And so with those shows that what about with the corporate client? I mentioned earlier about trying to customize something for the group. Do you do the same thing? Do you customize for your
No, not really. No, I have to say I've got like the children's show, I've also got actors known for the adults as well. You know, it's mm-hmm. something that you know, I've done for many years, and again, you know, you might come across an odd routine, but I don't do, I have to be honest, I don't do many corporate shows as such anyway. It's more for the Masonics, we used to be a big business over here. Hmm. Not so much now, but it used to be, you know, used to do the Masonics, the Ladies' Night, and as I say, I said earlier, the clubs, the Working Men's Clubs, British Legions and this kind of thing. But I do basically the same act for all of them. You know, it's a different audience each time, so it doesn't matter.
Well, that's what I was going to ask as well, because I would think if you would do the Masons, you'd come back again to the lodge and have the same people. But
yes, well, as I said, I don't get repeat bookings.
Yeah, okay.
Seen once, that's it. They don't want it anymore. Yeah.
Seen once, that's enough. Okay.
Yeah.
You want the new money, right? Not the old money. So. Well, what would you say is the core? What's the basis of your act? What are the effects?
Well, the adult act?
Yes.
The base of my adult act? Well, it's basically, we used to call it the Up the Garden Path routine. You know, I start off by borrowing somebody's banknote and shred it to pieces. And then I borrow his watch and smash that up. Borrow his ring and I lose that. And it's a running gag right the way through the show. But
it's no wonder you ever never come back and do a second show for anybody.
I go back to give it back to the. So I had one situation not so long ago, it was a close-up thing, actually. And I vanished a guy's £20 banknote and I forgot to give it back to him. I opened the thought center. I found I still got it. I hadn't given him. I hadn't taken it out.
So you actually returned home and still had his money.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say that happened to me one time.
I was back his coat.
It was what in the back of your coat?
I say when I found I came off doing a close up session. And I got to the next table and I opened this salt cellar where the note, and I realized the note was still there. I'd forgotten to give it back to him. So I had to sheepishly go back to his table and give him back his note.
Oh, so at least you did return the money.
Of course. There was one occasion where I didn't, where this is many years ago, when I was finished up by producing the banknote and gave it back to the chap, and he had a few more too much to drink. And in those days, it was a £5 note. He said, "Oh, it was a wonderful, wonderful attitude. Please keep the £5 note." I said, no. I said, "Are you sure?" No, you keep it. And we're having an argument. And in the end, I thought, the best stop the argument. I said, thank you very much. Sir. Thank you very much. Good night and God bless.
From what I've seen also, that you do a linking finger ring routine.
I do indeed, yes, the Himba ring, yes. I've got my own routine with it I've used for many, many years. And I start by using the ring flight, and then I go into – I've got a thing about repetition in magic. Mm-hmm. It's like the Chinese rings. You know, once you link two solid rings together, I feel that is the trick. You've done magic, you've linked – but when you do it for 15 minutes – linking eight rings, it kind of loses its impact somehow.
I agree.
I was always the same thing with the finger rings. That I think once you've joined two rings together in the guy's hand, you've just performed a miracle. You've put two borrowed finger rings and linked in his hand. But to do another one and another one, I think he's overdoing it. The only one I know who can get away with that is Nick Lewin.
I was just about to say, Nick uses five rings,
Nick
I believe.
Lewin, he's got a fantastic routine with it, you know. But with mine, I actually link the third item would be the key that from the ring flight. So when the ring is changed into the key, I use that key to link on to the second ring, you know. So you've got two rings and a key linked together. That's how, without trying to go into complete detail, that's what the effect is.
But you actually start with a ring flight? You don't finish with ring flight?
I start with a ring flight, and the ring appears. I take the key off. I'm just trying to think there. Take the key off, then the ring appears on the end of the wallet, the key wallet, the key ring, and then the key that I'd taken off originally, it's changed to the key. I then use that in the linking ring routine. I'm sorry, it sounds a bit complicated.
No, but, that's fine. I saw the video, and I'll for those who are listening to this on the blog, if you go to the website. I'm sorry,
oh,
for those who are
YouTube.
Listening. Yeah, it's on YouTube.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I'll put this on the blog. So again, those who are listening to the podcast can go back to the blog and they can view
that one I did on the YouTube. I actually did the key. The ring on the shoelace. But normally I use it in the key ring.
Ah, I see. Okay. And so you have that's about a 12-minute routine, you say, or so?
It's about 10 minutes altogether. Mm-hmm.
And then you have a vanishing bill, or you said it was a bill in the salt cellar, but that's more of a strolling kind of a thing, or do you do that on stage?
Sorry, what, the bill routine?
Yeah, the bill routine?
Yeah, it's done on stage or cabaret, yes, yeah.
Right, right. And what do you use typically as a closer?
You're asking me questions now. You see, I'll get everybody licking my axe.
Oh, well, then never mind. No, I don't want you to share that. Yes, I'm sorry.
I will tell you, between you and I, no, nobody else is listening to this. the bill is found inside a sausage at the end.
Ah, that's quite different, certainly. Yeah.
It is. Right. And the corner that we've torn off with the number on, I actually finished by restoring the note and giving the guy back his note restored at the end.
When you do that, yeah, I wondered about that. That, I'll do a bill in lemon or whatever, and usually that the bill is torn or it's mangled or it's wet or dirty or, you know, whatever it comes out. Do you find that it's best to leave it in that condition so they can tell the story, or do you give them the option saying?
No. I think the way I work it is that I borrow the bill, in £20 note, say, I tear the corner off with the number on, which I give to the guy.
Sure.
The rest of it, I use a shredder, a hand shredder.
Yes, right.
And we used to set fire to it in the old days.
Yep, that's exactly.
There are so many buildings now with fire alarms.
Fire alarms.
I've closed two hotels in the past through this, so I don't do that anymore. I shred it.
Yeah.
And it's a running gag through the act that I can't find his note until right at the end I do this routine with a pack of sausages. And he chooses a sausage, and inside the sausage is his banknote with the corner missing, and he takes the corner out of his pocket and he checks that it is his note. And to finish off with, I basically do a bill switch and I restore the note and give him back his note. And he goes back very happy. I think to give him back the note with the corner torn off it or mangled in any way would be very bad manners.
Well, yeah, I have been wrestling with that myself. Again, whenever that it would come out of a lemon or something or a banana or something where that it's, again, mangled or damp or whatever, that I will give them a napkin and say, here, you can clean it off and then take it back to your seat. And that's the majority of the way that I leave it. So that's the way that I feel that they can, if they want a fresh one, they can come back to me. And this happened only once in hundreds of times that I've done this. They said, can I have a clean bill? Could you replace it? And I've done that. And a couple of times I've actually asked them on stage, would you like to, and I'll, I like to use a $100 bill, and so I'll pull out another $100 and say, do you want to exchange that for this? And more times than not, they have said, no, I'll keep this one. Because, again, I believe they like to tell the story, and they'll keep that. And, in fact, I've had that happen where that you know, more than a year later, that someone will pull that bill out of their wallet and say, "Remember, you did this, you know, for me," and you could still smell the lemon freshness, you know, because they would tell the story.
I don't think that happened over here. We don't hang on to money as long as that.
talking about smoke and problem with the fire and everything. Of course, one of my favorite routines was going back to Terry Seabrook for a moment. Was his cigarette and coat routine was just the most brilliant routine ever, and so well scripted, and the timing and with the lines and everything that it couldn't be added to nor taken away from. Did that seems like forever, and that really got to be a reputation maker, certainly. But before long, right. Number one, there was problem with just smoke, that could set off a fire alarm.
Yeah, yeah.
But most importantly, people stopped smoking, and you can't smoke inside buildings anymore. So
no, that's right. That's right. Yeah, things have changed a lot since the old days.
They have. Do you think for the better or the worse?
Personally, for the worst, but it's only my own personal opinion.
I understand. Are there some things like that you have taken out of your act because that they are, I don't know.
Well, there's certain lines that I've taken out of the act which are not PC correct in this day and age.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've heard it said that some comedians, like over here in the U.S., that Jerry Seinfeld couldn't work college circuit anymore because that the college circuits are so politically correct that they won't allow you to say certain things that will work in a comedy club but not in a comedy setting in a collegiate situation. And I'm sure it's the same way over there, that they're probably very very cautious as to what you can say or do and things that you have to take out because you don't want to, make someone upset because if you do that one person, yeah. Maybe the person who could have hired you in the future but won't now.
Yeah, I can understand what you're saying, but there are situations like today. I mean, we have comedians on the television and they're using all the four-letter language. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely revolting. The kind of language that they use, but they mustn't be homophobic or sexist or racist, and it doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
They could use bad language, but you mustn't say anything that can be interpreted as being racist or sexist or homophobic. I agree with that, but why do they have to use the language as well? I'm sorry. Maybe it's an age thing, a generation thing, but I don't like it at all.
Well, no, I know what you're saying about that. I mean, I've watched Graham Norton's show, for an example, Graham has guests on there and they'll use certain language, but that I don't think is appropriate either. And over here in the U.S. is often bleeped out on the BBC America that we have. But I know what they're saying. They can't say that on television here that they do get away with over there. But you're right. They wouldn't be saying something else that would be considered politically incorrect.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. With that, you said that there were a lot of children's shows and everything that you did. And when I was watching some other things that you have done, like on restaurants and kind of strolling magic, that you've got a lot of things that are good for not only adults but also for children. So now restaurant work in the UK is completely different from over here from the standpoint that here a lot of times much of the pay is based upon tipping, the tips that magicians would get here, which you don't tip.
No, not at all here.
Yeah,
you're quite right in what you're saying. You know, the tipping is a big thing over in the States. Over here, no. You might tip your barber or your taxi driver, and your waiter or your waitress. But that's about as far as it goes. As far as magic is concerned, doing the tables, you go for it. You get a fee, and that's it. You know, and obviously nobody. Nobody offers you a tip either, you know. But sometimes, having said that, I mean, with children's shows, you do get a very generous client who might put a fiver on top of the bill. Mm-hmm. But it's not that often it happens.
And the same thing, I guess, like when working weddings. I doubt that they tip much with that.
Sorry, say that again?
For weddings, do they tip much or at all for weddings?
No. The tipping is not used at all over here very much. It's just a case you negotiate a fee And that's what you get, you know, and that's what you expect as well.
Well, again, over here, one of the places where magicians can work doing strolling and close-up magic with, you know, much of what is sold, it seems like today, are more and more close-up types of tricks and card tricks and little gimmicks and whatnot. There are fewer and fewer illusionists and dove workers and, you know, stage workers, basically. And I don't know if it's because of the cost of it or the having to transport the big show or whatever, but my point is over here that the place where people can make some money is, of course, strolling. In my case, that I work restaurants for, gosh, 30 years over here and do well, and I'd probably say I at least double or triple my income with tips over here. So it's something that is expected. But over there, I wouldn't think that there are a lot of restaurant workers necessarily. Because in other words, why would you want to go and work a restaurant unless the restaurant was paying you to perform?
Exactly.
If you're not going to be getting tips. And is that pretty much the case? Are there very many people?
Yeah. I mean, I don't do many. I have done restaurants in the past. And again, it's done, you know, they give you a fee and that's it. In the old days, when I first started, and I'm going back quite a few years now, there was no such thing as commercial close-up magic. You didn't go around with a pack of cards in your pocket. If you were in a club, my father was a representative of a brewery over here, and he used to take me around the pubs and the clubs when I was a young man, and they'd throw me a dog-eared deck of cards that was used behind the bar for a game of crib or something, mm-hmm. and I'd do a few tricks for them in the bar there. This was just for fun. But you never, ever got paid to do close-up magic. The only time you did close-up magic was for your friends or to advertise your stand-up act. Now, of course, it's completely different. Today, the young guys, now, there is no stage work over here now. There's very, very little stage work to be had. Mm-hmm. It's all done by close-up agent and the youngsters, and I can't blame them at all. They go out and they get do good business. Some of them are earning very good money doing just strolling magic. But the whole scene, as I said earlier, it's completely changed now to what it was in my day.
Well, I know there are a lot of mentalists, people doing mentalism over in the UK.
Well, it's a big thing now. Yeah.
Right, right. I know with Darren Brown and others who have really brought that to the fore.
Yeah. Well, in my day, the mentalist was Fogel, the amazing Fogel, Maurice Fogel, and
right.
Alperin, who immigrated to the States. Mm-hmm. They are the two that stand out. There were also the act called the Zomers. Madame Zoma, was it? Yes, and they used to do a double mental act, you know, a man or woman. I mean, there wasn't many doing the mental. I can understand why they're doing mentalism now, because nobody believes in magic anymore, but there's still a question mark of whether there is anything to be had in telepathy and mentalism. So it is popular, hence the success of Darren Brown. He was his... you know, magic and psychology, and it's very, very successful. It's very big now.
Right. Did you put very much, or have you put any mentalism in your routines?
No. I, to be honest, I think you're either a magician or a mentalist. I mean, mixing the two, I personally don't think it is a good idea. I do talks.
Yeah.
I do talks for various organizations, which is nice because I do a break. It's a break away from doing the act. I don't do the act. I talk about my life in magic, and I do a demonstration of different aspects of magic, like scams, doing the three-card Monty.
Right.
The cups and balls leads into that. And I do a demonstration of mentalism in that. And I do a psychotelic analysis routine, which is basically a rising card routine. And another routine for the ESPs, but yeah, you know, that's a success. You know, it seems to go well doing the different aspects, showing them the different kinds of magic that there are.
Right. I mentioned David Berglas a little bit earlier. Did you or do you know David very well?
Yes, I know him quite well. Yes, he. When I was the president of the International Bud and Magicians British Ring, he was also the president of the Magic Circle at that time,
mm-hmm.
and. But I've known David from way back when, again, I used to look up to him when I was a youngster, you know, and he was very successful.
Very much so, yeah, the international man of mystery.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Yes, yes. A very, very clever magician.
Anything in particular that comes to mind that you'd seen of his that impressed you as a youth?
What, from David Burgess?
Yes.
Well, Eddie Carl Called For was always his routine that used to blow us away. You know, I still don't know how he does it.
Right. Well, I remember seeing and hearing and reading about, and then finally seeing at the Magic Circle Centenary some years ago when he was making the round table.
Floating table.
Table, and then spinning around and everything. Yeah, that was phenomenal as well. There was another mentalist that I had heard about that was on the UK television and was quite popular. Ooh, boy, I want to say, was that in the 50s, 60s sometime?
What was his name?
Roy?
I think I know you mean possibly two. Sorry?
I was going to say, Roy. Is Roy still there? Maybe he might think of the fellow, too. I can't think of the fellow's name offhand, but it seems
that... the mentalist on television, he was Cassandra, but suddenly it was at one name. It began with C.
Yeah, it'll come to me in a minute.
I believe you're right.
Not Corinda.
No.
Sorry?
Not Corinda. No.
Corinda, no. He did quite a bit of television. He was well known. He did a lot of psychological magic.
Yeah. Right, where he
would... I know what you mean. I thought I've got a book on him upstairs somewhere.
Yeah, he'd go through a magazine or a book or something, and just someone would look at a page, and he would tell you what page it is that you looked at or something, kind of like that. And people I had heard about the next day were talking about him because, I mean, it was so phenomenal.
Well, it was very novel in those days, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, and people did believe in it, you know. I mean, look when Uri Geller came over here. You know, I mean, everybody believed what he was doing was real.
Sure, exactly. Right. Spoon bending and everything else that he is most noted for. Yeah, that is that's very true. But there are some other magicians who you work with or some friends that you knew pretty well.
One who was a dear friend of mine was Ali Bongo.
Yes,
and Ali helped me a lot when I created the Great Fiasco Act, which I toured a lot round. I don't know whether you're familiar with that. It was a silent cod act that I did called The Great Fiasco.
I've heard that, yes.
Yeah, he kindly opened a lot of doors for me in various conventions. But I also did it commercially as well in nightclubs. But the beauty of that was that it was only a 10-minute spot. And there was no patter, so I don't speak the lingo. I only know English, Yiddish and rubbish. That's all I know. So being a silent act, it was good. It got me all sorts of places.
I was going to say, you can perform that anywhere in the world, obviously, if it's a silent comedy act.
Exactly that. Yeah. And it was very continentalist type of act as well. It was a satire of a magical manipulator. But Ali, as I said, helped me a lot in that. And then, of course, the other one I really admired was Alan Saxon.
Yes, of course.
He was a lovely guy.
Another president, past president of the Magic Circle.
Yes, he was a president of the Circle, yeah.
Right. Did you ever know Robert Harbin?
Not personally, no. Okay. I saw him many times, of course, and I did meet him once, but I can say I knew him, you know. But again, great character, great personality, yeah.
Right, yeah, he was always just a very creative guy.
The clock, the grandfather clock striking. Oh.
I thought maybe you dropped a spoon in your teacup or something. Or...
Yes, for my next trick.
Well, Ali Bongo was another friend, as was Pat Page and Terry Supercook, who we mentioned a little bit earlier. And Ali was someone who was a very creative guy. And we're talking about television a little bit earlier, and he'd done a lot of work with people on TV.
Who was that?
Ali Bongo.
Ali Bongo. Oh, yes. Well, of course, he was the advisor for David Nixon. And then following up, he was the advisor for Paul Daniels.
Right.
Ali Bongo and Pat Page, I think, are two of the most knowledgeable men in magic over here.
I could see that. And that the time I spent with both of them, it seems like that they were just creative geniuses, and it's just kind of was nice. You know, I worked with them once at the Castle of Magic, and we were in Stirling Castle one weekend, and I was the compere for the weekend and introducing them. And the evenings that I spent with them, it was great. You know, that in fact, I guess it was Pat that had taught my wife how to make the perfect cup of tea. So, I mean, there was... his knowledge was boundless, as far as she was concerned. But yeah, when he came over to the 4F convention, the Effectors Finger Flicking Frolic here, that they always had the Pat Page teach in, and he always had a lot of really good ideas and things, which was interesting because it seems like everything that we do today would stem back to something that he had created or had some influence in one way or another. Just was quite a brilliant gentleman.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, one of his tricks, Easy Money, I think it was called.
Yeah,
and it's been brought out in so many different forms, but basically it was Pat Page's original. You know?
Yeah, was that something that
I used the Fred Capps?
I was going to say Fred Capps.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, did Fred Capps have a variation on that, or was that originally Fred's idea, or was that
Pat's?
Well,
that's the one I use all the time now.
Okay.
The Fred Capps version is the one I use all the time, you know. And Ken Brook put that out. He was in one of the lecture notes of Fred Capps, and Ken sold it in his shop. And, it's one I used to carry around with me all the time, you know.
That was someone that I always regret that I never had an opportunity to meet, was Fred Capps. He was supposed to have come over here one time when Joe Stevens had his Las Vegas Desert Seminars years ago, and Fred was going to be the guest of honor, but he was in the final stages, I believe, of cancer and couldn't make it at that time, and so I never got a chance. Did you ever meet Fred Capps?
Personally? Yes, I did, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he came over to England many years ago now, and he visited Ken because he was very good friends of Ken, and we met at the studio, and at that time Fred was doing his coin routine where he finished it with the Chinese coins.
Sure.
And we finished up in a pub down the road, as drinking a hostelry establishment, and Fred actually blew us away with his coin routine that he did, you know. But he had such a charming personality. Just to interrupt on that, we just come up with the name that you were trying to think of, the mentalist who was doing television over here.
Yes.
Was Chan Canasta.
Chan Canasta. Thank you very much. Yes.
Chan Canasta. Yeah.
Yep, that was the one. He was quite influential, I think, in getting people.
Oh, he was, yeah. Mm-hmm. He did the psychological stuff and the mind reading, and, yeah, very effective.
Right.
He took a few risks, mind you, you know.
Yes, he seems like that from what I've read, that he wondered about how he did it. Well, it was just nerves, you know, he kind of lived on the edge, you know. He just tried it, but it worked fine.
Don't we all?
That's right. You mentioned the two-person mind reading act that were...
The Zodiacs.
Yes.
The Zodiacs. That's right, yes. It was. There were several working over here. One couple was what was this? The Spencers. Nancy Spencer.
Oh, yes.
And her husband. They're all gone now. And they did please now tell me what have I got in my hand now routine.
Right.
And, but there's also, as I say, the Zodias were the famous ones here. Yeah. And of course, there's another couple that I came across at one of the conventions, and I got them booked for our British convention. What's the name of them? The young couple. Very, very good. They use various methods.
I know Jeff and Tessa Everson are great.
Yes, that's it. You got it.
They're a wonderful couple. I love them.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, some years ago, there was another couple that I had heard about, and I'd seen their posters. I don't want to say they were from Australia, possibly. It wasn't something like the Pinkertons or something like the Pickerings?
The Piddingtons.
Piddingtons, thank you. Yes.
Yes. Oh, now, I've done a study on the Piddingtons.
Oh, really? Tell me something about them.
I did a complete research on them.
Oh, wow. You're the guy.
Well, I remember them very clearly on the radio, and there are two books out. One was called The Piddingtons by Russell Braddon, and which is the story of them. Very briefly, Sidney Piddington was a prisoner of war in Singapore, in the Chiang Mai, and he met up with Russell Braddon, and they developed this telepathy act, which took the heat off them. And then when they were liberated, he went back to Sydney, and that's where he met Leslie, who was actually a radio actress.
Mm-hmm.
And they got married, and they developed this mental act that he developed with Russell Braddon. And it was hugely successful. And they came over here, and I think it was about 1952 they came to the UK. I don't know, did they ever play the States? I don't know.
Not to my knowledge, no.
No. But they were terrific, you know. Just recently, a book has been written which is actually exposes their methods.
But oh, really?
They fooled everybody at the time.
Really?
I'm trying to think of his name. I haven't got my hand on the book at the moment. I've got it upstairs. But the guy, actually, his grandfather was at BBC Studios taking notes of the methods that they were using. And I'm certainly not going to go into them now.
No,
but it's absolutely fascinating. And they took a lot of chances. But they were amazing. I mean, I remember you could get it on YouTube. There's where she is in the plane.
In the airplane, yes.
And he is in the studio, and somebody's chosen a word out of a book or a line, and he would transmit it to her in the plane that was flying above. And and the method was exposed in this book, which is a shame. But as I say, because I was doing a research on it, I got both books. In fact, I was extremely lucky because I got it off, I think it was Amazon. The first book, mm-hmm. The Pinkertons by Russell Braddon. And when I opened the front page, not only was it signed by Russell Braddon, but also by Leslie Pinkerton and Sidney Pinkerton
as
well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was a wonderful find.
Wow, I should say so.
Yes, it's a fascinating story. A lot of people have never heard of them, you know, but I remember them very clearly.
Well, there was a podcast that I was listening to about this some time ago, and if I can find it, I'll put a link on the on the website here, so people can come back and take a listen to this also. But there, apparently the fellow who was, I think, a great-grandchild, or maybe the grandson, or maybe, I think it was a great-grandson, had gone back and had found his grandmother, I guess Mrs. Pinkerton, and was trying to find out more, because he had found a poster or something. He said, wait a minute, you know, that's me. And one thing kind of led to another, because he didn't realize who they were or how famous they were and what they did. But the more he got into it, it just got to be more and more interesting. Along with this, of course, she did not explain to him the methods of some of the things that they had done. So he never learned from his own
blood
relative, I guess, how that was done.
That story is quite correct. She didn't even, in fact, at that time, she'd forgotten how they were done, because she was suffering from dementia, unfortunately.
I see.
And it was unable to, but she wouldn't tell anybody the secrets of them. But the guy who wrote the book I was talking about earlier on is Martin T. Hart, and it's called Pinkerton's Secrets. We know how they did it, and I'm it's all exposed in there. Roy's just got it up for me on the internet here.
Ah, interesting. So,
so, you know, if you can get hold of that book, whether it can be done today, of course, it's another story.
Well, that's a good point, because a lot of that, again, as you say, that Terry was done on the radio, and it's kind of like that. It's hard enough to get people to believe things that are happening on television, because they're thinking that it's some sort of trick photography.
Exactly right.
To do something on the radio. That's why I thought, you know, long ago when Edgar Bergen would do ventriloquism, you'd think, well, that's the last thing that you'd think would work on radio is ventriloquism, but he was immensely popular.
Yeah, well, we had the same here. We had a guy called Peter Brough and Archie Andrews. And that was exactly the same, like you say, about Edgar Bergen. He was a ventriloquist on the radio. Unfortunately, when television came out, he wasn't a very good ventriloquist. He didn't know which one was talking, the doll or him.
Yeah.
But for radio, he was perfect.
Right. Well, and similarly, that the way that they built up the routines that the Pinkertons were doing on the radio, that it sounded fantastic. And because you were creating these images in your mind, again, like her being in the airplane and him in the studio, it's another things that are happening, that it seemed to play so well. But again, if you do that today, I think it would just be kind of, people would think, that's something done in the studio, and they would dismiss it. I just don't think it would necessarily be as popular.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. And also that type of act would be probably too slow for today as well.
Well, that's a good point, too. You know, you look back from what I've heard about Harry Houdini's act of trying to get
exactly
out.
Exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, he would
with an audience sit there for 2 hours waiting for him to escape in today's age?
Maybe not. Exactly right. Things have certainly changed. As you said, not necessarily for the better. You know,
that's true.
People
that's
just true. Don't sit still in the movies, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, along that line, there have been a lot of people we've discussed over here, people that you've met, and many of them good friends of yours. Who would you say really has been, impressed you the most?
Impressed me the most?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose the person who really impressed me was Ken Brook, to be mm-hmm. honest.
Yeah.
You know, I used to stand by his stand when he was demonstrating at a convention in his booth, I think you call it over there now.
Yes.
And I'd stand there for hours watching him. And so much so that I know I mentioned the New Year's. There was another trick called the spot sticks, where the spots jump from one stick to the other. It was a paddle trick.
Yeah, like a hot rod.
And I watched him for so long that when I went home and showed my dad the trick, he said, "Well, why do you do that trick in a pseudo Yorkshire accent?" And the reason was that I stood watching him do this trick for so long, I couldn't help picking up his accent as well. "And I got 2 sticks here, and 1 spot goes in, and look at that." And that was it. And every time I did that trick, I went into his Yorkshire accent. But yeah, and so if you call it influence, that was influence. But he was a great character. Yeah, he was a very aggressive salesman. He used to amaze me how he got away with the sale, because sometimes he was quite rude to some of his customers.
Oh, really?
But it was what we call the negative sale, you know. And they still came back to him in the end, you know.
Right.
And he was a great one for practical jokes as well.
Wow. You know, of course, I think that today's master demonstrator, an unparalleled, is Mark Mason.
Yes, well, I think I've said to Mark many times that if he's the definitely the
Ken Brook incarnate.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
I'm reading your mind too over the airwaves.
Yeah. Can you read my mind? What am I thinking? Yeah. No, he was though. He is the nearest demonstrator I've ever seen to Ken Brook is Mark Mason. Definitely.
Yeah. Mark is very impressive, and he always has the biggest draw in his booth. I think just about any place he goes.
Another one of your compatriots also that I found was a lovely demonstrator was Al Cohen.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was a great demonstrator as well, Al Cohen. You know what I'm talking about.
Al Cohen in Washington, D.C.
Washington, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he's retired.
Reason, I was thinking Al Coran. I was thinking not Al Coran, but Al Cohen.
No.
Yeah, two different completely guys.
Yeah, you could say so, yeah.
Exactly. Well, I tell you, this has just been fantastic, and I appreciate your time for spending some over here this afternoon with me a little bit. Terry, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast, and so I always like to ask my guests at the end over here what it is that's your magic word. What is your philosophy? It doesn't have to be a word. It could be a phrase, something that is important to you.
A phrase important to magic?
Well, important to you. I mean, what is it that's your philosophy? What do you live by? What's important when you get up in the morning that it's making you go all day long? It's like, you know, this is what I live for. This is important to me.
It's to make it entertaining.
Ah, I like that.
It's simple as that. If you can make that magic entertaining, then you'll be a success. Unfortunately, I've seen many magicians who are brilliant, technically absolutely fantastic, but will bore you to tears. And that's as being a magician. So no, make your act entertaining, and the biggest crime you can commit is to bore your audience.
Yeah, that's true. You don't want to leave them bored. You want to leave them entertained. You know, it kind of reminds me a little bit, I guess, John Archer has a lecture, and one of the things he talks about is fire. It should be funny, interesting, relevant, and entertaining.
Exactly right, yeah.
You know, in order to entertain the audience over there. But, yeah, keep it entertaining. Well, Terry, thank you again very much. And Roy Marsh, thank you very much for helping to set this up. It's been fantastic.
Yes.
So thank you guys very much again for
you're welcome.
For being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome, and thank you very much. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Terry Herbert, and this is Scotty out.
Bye.
Well, that certainly was some fun. I want to thank you, Terry, and also to Roy Marsh for helping to make this podcast happen. And I am glad that we finally got connected in order to put this thing together. And also I want to thank our listener who had made this suggestion, Tim Glander. So thank you, Tim. And also, if any of the rest of you happen to have any ideas or suggestions for guests we can have here on the Magic Word Podcast, just drop me a note and I'll try to see if perhaps we can line up something. You can get hold of me by contacting me by email at scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. All right, well, now it's time again for a couple of product reviews from Murphy's Magic Supplies. This week we're going to cover not one, but two different DVDs. One DVD includes not only the DVD itself, but also the necessary props or gimmicks and things that you need to do the trick. Well, mostly. We'll get into that. The other one is exclusively just a DVD. First up, by Magic Tao, is Chris Congreves, who presents his trick called Horoscope. This is a DVD that I thought sounded like a pretty good idea. I like doing something with a horoscope. I thought it might be kind of organic and trying to figure out someone's astrological sign. Actually, not so much. This is something which you ask them what their astrological sign is, and then just through time misdirection, then later you bring it up and you mention what their sign is, but they would have forgotten that because there are some other things that you get with this DVD that make all this work. Specifically, that you get the necessary cards. Well, let me restate that. You get some playing cards. You don't necessarily need these because you have a deck at home and you could actually use your own playing cards, but it's kind of nice that they give you some cards to go along with this. The most important thing, however, that they do supply you is the page from a magazine. Now, there are a couple different pages that they give you. This appears to be something that is torn out of a magazine, and essentially it is printed on one side with some things of a Norwegian vacation. On the other side, it's just a listing of different astrological signs and horoscopes that are associated with different signs. Both of these pages are identical, except that one is a little bit more serious and has a little bit more detailed explanation of their horoscope, whereas the other one is just a shorter one or two line description and more of a comedic type of description that you might want to use, depending upon the presentation. This is something that can be used for a close-up or stage. On the one side that has the Danish tourism picture, there are some other built-in tricks that you can do that, which, of course, cleverly enough, would have the gray elephant in Denmark kind of a thing. Now, for me, one of the downsides of this particular gimmick that comes with it is the magazine page is something that I would have to explain came from a foreign magazine. Specifically, for an example, in bold letters and near the top where it says Visit Denmark, it says from £399. So this obviously isn't something that you would have torn from a magazine in the U.S. It would have been some other foreign magazine. So just saying, while on your travels, that I happen to be overseas and I pulled this out because it's kind of interesting to see how horoscopes would vary from one country to another. And let's see how if this perhaps matches with yours, because I pulled this out of an English magazine while I was over touring in Scotland or in England or in Ireland, Wales, wherever. So the point being is that this is something that appears to be from a magazine outside of the United States, specifically someplace where they use British pounds. So that's one thing to keep in mind, the gimmick that you get. The other thing, as I said, is not necessarily a gimmick. You get 12 cards, one for each of the astrological signs, and they're just regular cards, but that allows you to customize this the way you wish. In other words, that these particular cards that you receive, I think is kind of an interesting and a clever idea, is using jumbo index cards, because the jumbo index cards, of course, you have a lot of room around the borders so you can write more things. And I kind of like that idea whenever that you're going to be having someone sign a card anyhow, because if you're just doing a random pick a card, sign a card type of a trick, there are odds, of course, that your volunteer is going to select a face card. And if they do, they really can't sign the face and you see it very clearly. Whereas if you use a jumbo index card, then that works much better because you have a lot more white space around the border of the card. Anyhow, just a little aside, I like the idea, and that's what you get. Again, the 12 cards in the jumbo index. Now, the other thing that you don't receive, of course, is the rest of the deck of cards, and you'll have to have a jumbo index cards. And so that is one thing that you would need to use with this. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, would be you'd need to have a wallet that you could use for a card-to-wallet type of routine, a CAPS wallet, a LaPaul wallet, any kind of a card-to-wallet. Now, that's not necessary that you have one. It does add to the routine, and of course, if you don't have one, then there are a variety on the market. I highly recommend that you get one if you don't have one and that you use regularly. I use mine in every show all the time in my strolling environment. I use a Fire wallet that is a CAPS wallet also, so I get a couple of different effects out of it. I love it. It's a wonderful thing. Basically, again, you don't have to have it because Chris teaches you some other ideas of how that you can use this effect using just an envelope. And so you don't need to have that. And if you're afraid of palming, you don't have to do that necessarily either because there's a no-palm method that he talks about in doing this. So the routine is good. The effect is solid. It's has some built-in jokes and everything. I would say this is pretty much a beginner type of an effect. It's not anything that takes a lot of efforts nor skill necessarily to perfect. I would say that it's not necessarily something that I'm going to do as I thought that I was. I mean, I first read the description. I thought this was something that I might be able to put into my routine. But upon inspection and kind of watching the DVD and looking at the props and everything, probably not. And at least for me, the reason would be that it's just something extra to carry around for this one effect. And there are other things, in my opinion, that are stronger than what this is. This is a good middle piece. It's not a closer, in my opinion. So this is something that you could do if you would like to do something that has to do with astrological signs. I think that it's a clever idea, but again, it necessitates not only carrying around the card to wallet, which you could use other kinds of routines with that, but this is something that once that you have done that card to wallet, then you really can't do the card to wallet again. Really, that's one of those types of tricks. It's like, wow, that's a great trick. And there are other things that perhaps you can do with a card to wallet that are more impressive than with this. Number two is that you have to carry around an extra deck of cards that has the names of the astrological signs that are written on these cards, because you may or may not necessarily be using a jumbo index deck of cards. So if you're going to be doing this for the local magic club or for a one-trick type of a thing, or you're going to be working someplace where that you can have a moment to set up, then I think this is an excellent trick for that type of a environment or where that you can perform this one trick. It's not easily and instantly repeatable. Let me say resettable, I should say, because there are some things you need to reset and take back out and put out once that you have done this. I mean, it doesn't take much time, maybe less than 30 seconds, but still, you have all this stuff out. So there again, if you have done this in the context of a performance and you have something you're going to do after that, you can put all this away, but then you're going to have a pocket full of other stuff. And again, pocket management is very important to me, and this is something that is just an additional space you would have to make for this trick, and there are other things that I think are a little bit stronger. Now, it's all in presentation, and I think that if you put the right presentation with this, could be for you then a spectacular, outstanding feature. For me, maybe not so. But it might be something for you. And again, it's called Horoscope by Chris Congreves, put out by Magic Tao. Next up is a DVD by J.C. James called Sparks. This is just one DVD. It says 13 Amazing Effects. And I understand that after watching this, the title must have come from just sparks of the imagination, because they all look like really good ideas where he was probably just sitting around and playing with cards or watching TV or fiddling around with something else and some inspiration hit him. I see that he says on the DVD that he had been playing with this for a long time and it's taken a number of years for this to come together and put them all into one DVD. And again, he has not only the 13 different effects, but also with several of them, he spends some additional time for subchapters, if you will, that give you some additional ideas and tips on handling and some things that you can do to make these things work. The running time on this is approximately an hour and 17 minutes, and each of the tricks are pretty much all card related. I will also say that a lot of these things are they are more difficult. Sleight of hand, I would say this is not for the beginner. I would say intermediate to advanced, perhaps, but as I say at the end, that anything that's going to be worth doing is going to be worth practicing, and you should practice anything that you do anyhow, and that in this particular case that you should practice until the hard becomes easy and the easy looks beautiful. So that's exactly what you're going to have to do with this. Now, as I said, most of these 13 effects are all cards, but it does open with a very clever effect using a Sharpie pen, and I like that a lot. That's a nice little visual thing, but that kind of sets the stage also for some of the other things that follow, and that is that they're kind of angly. So not only are they a little bit difficult and knuckle-busting, which I don't mind at all, but I love those kinds of things, and I've worked on a couple of these things, kind of playing with them as well, but this is one also just right off the bat that you're going to probably want to do straight away, but it's kind of done one-on-one. It's one of those things that Sans Minds is perhaps best known for. This is not a Sans Minds DVD, by the way. This is a Murphy's Magic Supplies video. Anyhow, the idea on that, as I said, he has one that starts off with that. He's got another one that is a coin idea, which is called Unsleeve, which is kind of neat, and essentially that you would have someone hold out their hand, you show your hand as being empty, and then when you place your hand on top of theirs, then a coin will appear on their in their palm of their hand. It's called Unsleeve. How do you think that might be done? I think the title says it all. So anyhow, there's something done with that, and then also then another one with the rubber band. There it is fairly clever, in which a dollar bill and a rubber band exchange places, essentially, that one ends up in the hand and the other ends up in your pocket, and they kind of transpose places. And then there is also the very last trick is clever also, which is T2P, which essentially is a torn card, a signed card, which they don't realize that you tear during the presentation. And then when they see the face of the card and you put your hand over it, it looks like it's actually disappearing as you kind of move your fingers down the card, and then at some point you stop, pull it away, and the card actually is only about 2/3 of the card, and you hold it out, and then you have them look in your pocket, or you pull out then the other small torn piece. Kind of a clever idea and a nice way to finish. It's not necessarily anything real difficult as far as trying to work on, whereas a lot of the other ideas might be. I really like a lot of the other ideas, however. There was one little wave change that he does with a double that is very clever as to the getting into it, but the tips that he talks about I think are interesting also. For an example, it could be a dual reality type of thing where that you're showing one person a card, and then when you show it to another person, they have a completely different card. So again, it's a dual reality type of an idea. And there are other ideas on there that not only are kind of angly, but you have to perform rather quickly. He goes into a lot of detail on one called a fake tilt. And boy, as fast as he might still do it, to my eye, it still looks like something's going on there. You know, maybe if I would see him or someone else do that in real time, it might be more of a fooler. But it is a good idea, but again, that's kind of what this whole thing is, I think, is supposed to spark your imagination, just as these things had sparked his imagination, and he comes up with some other ideas and some routines, which, by the way, a lot of the things that he's talking about in here are not full-fledged routines. He shows a couple of places where he's performing outdoors, or he has a volunteer assist, and so you get some of the presentation and the pattern that goes with that, but for the most part of these 13 different tricks, they are just ideas and presentations for moves that you can use in the context of an overall other type of a routine that you might do. Anyhow, the name of this DVD again is called Sparks, and it's by J.C. James, and it's available also from Murphy's Magic Supplies. Both of these are available from your favorite dealer through Murphy's Magic Supplies. And as mentioned many times before, I hope that I'm one of your favorite dealers. If you just go over to themagicwordpodcast.com and you can click on the Magic Store, you can have access then to clicking on any of these types of tricks that have been reviewed on the Magic Word Podcast, read more about it, and if interested, you can order right there and add it to your cart, and it'll be shipped away right away to you. And so those are available from your favorite magic dealer, which again, hopefully will be themagicwordpodcast.com. Okay, well, I mentioned last week that we were announcing a new contest, which ran all this past week, and it was open to anyone in the world. We now have the names that are drawn for the three people who have won a copy of the book. And again, this is called A Magician Prepares, Act One Interviews by Joshua Sinkamp and by Jason Wethington. Again, a recommended book. I think it was fantastic. So let's announce the winners, and their names are John Barr, Fred King, and Peter Cook. Congratulations, guys. The books will be going out to you shortly. And again, I want to thank Jason Wethington and Joshua Sinkamp, for the authors, for offering these prizes to the winners this week here on the Magic Word Podcast. So thank all of you also who have entered the contest. And even though you didn't win, I would suggest that you might want to get your hands on a copy of this book, because again, I do really highly recommend it. I think it's really great reading, and you will enjoy it and learn a lot also. And you can go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there will be a link there on the Amazon affiliate page where that you can go to Amazon and order a copy of this book, and you can help support the Magic Word along with getting a great read as well. Well, I think it's about time to wrap up until next week, because we've got some more great stuff coming up next week as I travel to Los Angeles and to the Magic Castle. And so we'll begin another series of My Week at the Castle, and you'll be hearing some wonderful interviews, I'm sure, and some chats with some friends and people I'll be working with there at the castle and other people in and around the Hollywood area. So I think it'll be a lot of fun over the next few weeks. So stay tuned, and if you haven't subscribed to The Magic Word, be sure and do that then too. So, until next time, stay well, get booked, and remember to keep your magic entertaining, but never bore your audience. This is Scotty out.